Chapter 14. I kept thinking about what Max Berenson had said about Alicia's suicide attempt following her father's death. There was no mention of it in her file, and I wondered why. I rang Max the next day, catching him just as he was leaving the office. "I just want to ask you a couple more questions, if you don't mind. I'm literally walking out of the door. This won't take long." Max sighed and lowered the phone to say something unintelligible to Tanya.
5 minutes, he said. That's all you get.
Thanks, I appreciate it. You mentioned Alicia's suicide attempt. I was wondering which hospital treated her.
She wasn't admitted to hospital.
She wasn't?
Nope, she recovered at home. My brother looked after her.
But surely she saw a doctor. It was an overdose, you said.
Yes, and of course Gabriel got a doctor over, and the doctor, agreed to keep it quiet.
Who was the doctor? Do you remember his name?
There was a pause as Max thought for a moment. I'm sorry, I can't tell you. I can't recall.
Was it their GP?
No, I'm sure it wasn't. My brother and I shared a GP. I remember Gabriel made a point of asking me not to mention it to him.
And you're sure you can't remember a name?
I'm sorry.
Is that all? I have to go. Just one more thing. I was curious about the terms of Gabriel's will.
A slight intake of breath, and Max's tone instantly sharpened. His will? I really don't see the relevance.
Was Alicia the main beneficiary?
I must say, I find that rather an odd question.
Well, I'm trying to understand.
Understand what?
Max went on without waiting for me to finish, sounding annoyed.
I was the main beneficiary. Alicia had inherited a great deal of money from her father, so Gabriel felt she was well provided for, and so he left the bulk of his estate to me. Of course, he had no idea his estate would become so valuable after his death. Is that it?
And what about Alicia's will? When she dies, who inherits?
That, Max said firmly, is more than I can tell you, and I sincerely hope this will be our last conversation.
There was a click as he hung up. But something in his tone told me this wouldn't be the last I'd hear from Max Berenson. I didn't have to wait long. Diomedes called me into his office after lunch. He looked up when I walked in, but didn't smile.
What is the matter with you?
With me?
Don't play the idiot. You know who I had a call from this morning? Max Berenson. He says you contacted him twice and asked a lot of personal questions.
I asked him for some information about Alicia. He seemed fine with it.
Well, he's not fine now. He's calling it harassment.
Oh, come on. The last thing we need is a solicitor making a fuss. Everything you do must be within the confines of the unit and under my supervision. Understood? I was angry, but I nodded. I stared at the floor like a sullen teenager. Diomedes responded appropriately, giving me a paternal pat on the shoulder.
Theo, let me give you some advice. You're going about this the wrong way. You're asking questions, searching for clues like it's a detective story.
He laughed and shook his head.
You won't get to it like that.
Get to what?
The truth. Remember beyond. No memory, no desire. No agenda. As a therapist, your only goal is to be present and receptive to your feelings as you sit with her. That's all you need to do. The rest will take care of itself.
I know, I said. You're right.
Yes, I am. And don't let me hear you've been making any more visits to Alicia's relations, understood?
You have my word. Chapter 15. That afternoon I went to Cambridge to visit Alicia's cousin, Paul Rose. As the train approached the station, the landscape flattened out and the fields let in an expanse of cold blue light. I felt glad to be out of London. The sky was less oppressive and I could breathe more easily. I left the train along with a trickle of students and tourists, using the map on my phone to guide me. The streets were quiet. I could hear my footsteps echoing on the pavement. Abruptly, the road stopped. There was a wasteland ahead, muddy earth and grass leading to the river. Only one house stood alone by the river, obstinate and imposing, like a large red brick thrust into the mud. It was an ugly house, a Victorian monster. The walls were overgrown with ivy, and the garden had been overtaken by plants, weeds mostly. I got the sense of nature encroaching,
reclaiming territory that had once been hers. This was the house where Alicia had been born. It was where she spent the first 18 years of her life. Within these walls, her personality had been formed, the roots of her adult life, all causes and subsequent choices were buried here. Sometimes it's hard to grasp why it is that the answers to the present lie in the past. A simple analogy might be helpful. A leading psychiatrist in the field of sexual abuse once told me she had, in 30 years of extensive work with paedophiles, never met one who hadn't himself been abused as a child. This doesn't mean that all abused children go on to become abusers, but it is impossible for someone who was not abused to become an abuser. No one is born evil. As Winnicott puts it, a baby cannot hate the mother without the mother first hating the baby. As babies, we are innocent sponges, blank slates, with only the most basic needs present: to eat, shit, love, and be loved. But something goes wrong, depending on the circumstances into which we are born and the house in which we grow up. A tormented, abused child can never take revenge in reality, as she is powerless and defenseless, but she can, and must, harbour vengeful fantasies in her imagination. Rage, like fear, is reactive in nature. Something bad happened to Alicia, probably early in her childhood, to provoke the murderous impulses that emerged all those years later. Whatever the provocation, not everyone in this world would have picked up the gun and fired it point blank into Gabriel's face. In fact, most people could not. That Alicia did so points to something disordered in her internal world. That's why it was crucial for me to understand what life had been like for her in this house, to find out what happened to shape her, to make her into the person she became, a person capable of murder. I wandered further into the overgrown garden, through the weeds and waving wild flowers, and I made my way along the side of the house. At the back, there was a large willow tree, a beautiful tree, majestic, with long bare branches sweeping to the ground. I pictured Alicia as a child, playing around it and in the secret, magical world beneath its branches. I smiled. Then I felt uneasy suddenly. I could sense someone's eyes on me. I looked up at the house. There was a face at an upstairs window. An ugly face, an old woman's face, pressed against the glass, staring straight at me. I felt a strange, inexplicable shiver of fear. I didn't hear the footsteps behind me until too late. There was a bang, a heavy thud, and a stab of pain at the back of my head. And everything went black. Chapter 16. I woke up on the hard, cold ground on my back. My first sensation was pain. My head was throbbing, stabbing, like my skull had been cracked open. I reached up and gingerly touched the back of my head. "No blood," said a voice, "but you'll have a nasty bruise tomorrow, not to mention a crack and headache." I looked up and saw Paul Rose for the first time. He was standing above me, holding a baseball bat. He was about my age, but taller and broad with it. He had a boyish face and a shock of red hair, the same colour as Alicia's. He reeked of whiskey. I tried to sit up, but couldn't quite manage it. "Better stay there, recover for a sec."
"I think I've got concussion."
"Possibly."
"What the fuck did you do that for?"
"What did you expect, mate? I thought you were a burglar."
"Well, I'm not. I know that now. I went through your wallet. You're a psychotherapist."
He reached into his back pocket and pulled out my wallet. He tossed it at me. It landed on my chest. I reached for it.
"I saw your ID," he said. "You're at that hospital, the Grove."
I nodded, and the movement made my head throb.
"Yes."
"Then you know who I am. Alicia's cousin."
"Paul Rose."
He held out his hand.
"Here, let me help you up."
He pulled me up to my feet with surprising ease. He was strong. I was unsteady on my feet.
"You could have killed me," I muttered.
Paul shrugged.
You could have been armed. You were trespassing. What'd you expect? Why are you here?
I came to see you. I grimaced in pain. I wish I hadn't.
Come in, sit down for a second.
I was in too much pain to do anything other than go where he led me. My head was throbbing with every step. We went through the back door. The inside of the house was just as dilapidated as the outside. The kitchen walls were covered with an orange geometric design that looked 40 years out of date. The wallpaper was coming away from the wall in patches, curling, twisting, and blackening like it was catching fire. Mummified insects were hanging suspended from cobwebs in the corners of the ceiling. The dust was so thick on the floor it looked like a dirty carpet, and an underlying odour of cat piss made me feel sick. I counted at least 5 cats around the kitchen, sleeping on chairs and surfaces. On the floor, open plastic bags overflowed with stinking tins of cat food.
"Sit down," he said. "I'll make some tea."
Paul leaned the baseball bat against the wall by the door. I kept my eye on it. I didn't feel safe around him. Paul handed me a cracked mug full of tea.
"Drink this," he said. "You have any painkillers?"
"I've got some aspirin somewhere. I'll have a look."
"Here." He picked up a bottle of whiskey. "This'll help."
He poured some of the whiskey into the mug. I sipped it. It was hot, sweet, and strong. There was a pause as Paul drank his tea, staring at me. I was reminded of Alicia and that piercing gaze of hers.
"How is she?"
he asked eventually. He continued before I could reply.
"I've not been to see her. It's not easy getting away. Mum's not well. I don't like to leave her alone."
"I see. When was the last time you saw Alicia?"
"Oh, years. Not for a long while. We lost touch. I was at their wedding, and I saw her a couple of times after that, but Gabriel was quite possessive, I think. She stopped calling anyway once they got married, stopped visiting. Mum was pretty hurt, to be honest."
I didn't speak. I could hardly think with the throbbing in my head. I could feel him watching me.
"So, what did you want to see me for?" he asked.
"Just some questions. I wanted to ask you about Alicia, about her childhood."
Paul nodded and poured some more whiskey into his mug. He seemed to be relaxing now. The whiskey was having an effect on me too, taking the edge off my pain, and I was thinking better. Stay on track, I told myself. Get some facts and get the hell out of here.
"You grew up together?"
Paul nodded.
"Mum and I moved in when my dad died. I was about 8 or 9. It was only meant to be temporary, I think, but then Alicia's mother was killed in the accident, so Mum stayed on to take care of Alicia and Uncle Vernon."
"Vernon Rose, Alicia's father."
"Right. And Vernon died here a few years ago?"
"Yes, several years ago." He frowned.
"He killed himself. He hanged himself upstairs in the attic. I found the body."
"That must have been terrible."
"Yeah, it was tough. On Alicia, mostly. Come to think of it, that's the last time I saw her. Uncle Vernon's funeral. She was in a bad way."
Paul stood up. "You want another drink?"
I tried to refuse, but he kept talking as he poured more whiskey. "I never believed it, you know, that she killed Gabriel. It didn't make any sense to me."
"Why not?"
"Well, she wasn't like that at all. She wasn't a violent person."
"She is now," I thought, but I didn't say anything.
Paul sipped his whiskey.
"She's still not talking?"
"No, she's still not talking."
"Doesn't make sense. None of it. You know, I think she was..."
We were interrupted by a thumping, a banging on the floor above. There was a muffled voice, a woman's voice. Her words were unintelligible.
Paul leapt to his feet.
"Just a sec," he said, and walked out. He hurried to the foot of the stairs. He raised his voice.
"Everything all right, Mum?"
A mumbled response that I couldn't understand came from upstairs.
"What? Oh, all right, just a minute."
He sounded uneasy. Paul glanced at me across the hallway, frowning. He nodded at me.
"She wants you to go up."
Chapter 17. Steadier on my feet, but still feeling faint, I followed Paul as he thudded up the dusty staircase. Lydia Rose was waiting at the top of the stairs. I recognized her scowling face from the window. She had long white hair, spreading across her shoulders like a spider's web. She was enormously overweight, a swollen neck, fleshy forearms, massive legs like tree trunks. She was leaning heavily on her walking stick, which was buckling under her weight, and looked like it might give way at any moment.
"Who is he? Who is he?"
Her shrill question was directed to Paul, even though she was staring at me. She didn't take her eyes off me. Again, the same intense gaze I recognized from Alicia. Paul spoke in a low voice.
"Mum, don't get upset. He's Alicia's therapist, that's all, from the hospital. He's here to talk to me."
"You? What does he want to talk to you for? What have you done?"
"He just wants to find out a bit about Alicia."
"He's a journalist, you fucking idiot!"
Her voice approached a shriek.
"Get him out!"
"He's not a journalist. I've seen his ID, all right? Now, come on, Mum, please, let's get you back to bed."
Grumbling, she allowed herself to be guided back into her bedroom. Paul nodded at me to follow. Lydia flopped back with a deep thud. The bed quivered as it absorbed her weight. Paul adjusted her pillows. An ancient cat lay asleep by her feet. It was the ugliest cat I'd ever seen, battle-scarred, bald in places, one ear bitten off. It was growling in its sleep. I glanced around the room. It was full of junk, stacks of old magazines and yellowing newspapers, piles of old clothes. There was an oxygen canister by the wall and a cake tin full of medication on the bedside table. I could feel Lydia's hostile eyes on me the whole time. There was madness in her gaze. I felt quite sure of that.
"What does he want?"
she asked. Her eyes darted up and down feverishly as she sized me up.
"Who is he?"
"I just told you, Mum. He wants to know some background on Alicia to help him treat her. He's a psychotherapist."
Lydia left no doubt about her opinion of psychotherapists. She turned her head, cleared her throat, and spat onto the floor in front of me. Paul groaned.
"Mum, please."
"Shut up!"
Lydia glared at me.
"Alicia doesn't deserve to be in hospital."
"No," I said. "Where should she be?"
"Where do you think? Prison!"
Lydia eyed me scornfully.
"You want to hear about Alicia? I'll tell you about her. She's a little bitch. She always was, even as a child."
I listened and felt my head throbbing. Lydia went on with mounting anger.
"My poor brother Vernon, he never recovered from Eva's death. I took care of him. I took care of Alicia. And was she grateful?"
It was obvious no response was required. Not that she waited for one.
"You know how Alicia repaid me all my kindness? Do you know what she did to me?"
"Mum, please."
"Shut up, Paul!"
Lydia turned to me. I was surprised how much anger there was in her voice.
"The bitch painted me. She painted me without my knowledge or permission. I went to her exhibition and there it was, hanging there, vile, disgusting and obscene mockery."
Lydia was trembling with anger, and Paul looked concerned. He gave me an unhappy glance.
"Maybe it's better if you go now, mate. It's not good for Mum to get upset."
I nodded. Lydia Rose was not a well person, no doubt about that. I was more than happy to escape. I left the house and made my way back to the train station, with a swollen head and a splitting headache. What a fucking waste of time. I found out nothing, except it was obvious why Alicia had got out of that house as soon as she could. It reminded me of my own escape from home at the age of 18, fleeing my father. It was all too obvious who Alicia was running away from. Lydia Rose. I thought about the painting Alicia had done of Lydia. An obscene mockery, she called it. Well, time to pay a visit to Alicia's gallery and find out why the picture had upset her aunt so much. As I left Cambridge, my last thoughts were of Paul. I felt sorry for him, having to live with that monstrous woman, be her unpaid slave. It was a lonely life. I didn't imagine he had many friends, or a girlfriend. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised if he was still a virgin. There was something stunted about him, despite his size. something thwarted. I had taken an instant and violent dislike to Lydia, probably because she reminded me of my father. I would have ended up like Paul if I had stayed in that house, if I had stayed with my parents in Surrey at the beck and call of a madman. I felt depressed all the way back to London. Sad, tired, close to tears. I couldn't tell if I were feeling Paul's sadness or my own. Chapter 18. Kathy was out when I got home. I opened her laptop and tried to access her email, but with no luck, she was logged out. I had to accept the possibility that she might never repeat her mistake. Would I keep checking ad nauseam, give in to obsession, driving myself mad? I had enough self-awareness to appreciate the cliché I'd become, the jealous husband, and the irony that Kathy was currently rehearsing Desdemona in Othello hadn't escaped me. I should have forwarded the emails to myself that first night, as soon as I'd read them. Then I'd have some actual, physical evidence. That was my mistake. As it was, I had begun questioning what I had seen in the first place. Was my recollection to be trusted? I'd been stoned out of my mind after all. Had I misunderstood what I had read? I found myself concocting outlandish theories to prove Kathy's innocence. Maybe it was just an acting exercise. She was writing in character, in preparation for Othello. She had spent 6 weeks speaking in an accent when preparing for All My Sons. It was possible something similar was going on here, except the emails were signed by Kathy, not Desdemona. If only I had imagined it all, then I could forget it, the way you forget a dream. I could wake up and it would fade away. Instead, I was trapped in this endless nightmare of mistrust, suspicion, paranoia. Although on the surface little had changed, we still went for a walk together on Sunday, we looked like every other couple strolling in the park. Perhaps our silences were longer than usual, but they seemed comfortable enough. Under the silence, however, a fevered, one-sided conversation was taking place in my mind. I rehearsed a million questions. Why did she do it? How could she? Why say she loved me and marry me, fuck me and share my bed, then lie to my face and keep lying year after year? How long had it been going on? Did she love this man? Was she going to leave me for him? I looked through her phone a couple of times when she was in the shower, searching for text messages, but found nothing. If she'd received any incriminating texts, she had deleted them. She wasn't stupid, apparently, just occasionally careless. It was possible I'd never know the truth. I might never find out. In a way, I hoped I wouldn't. Kathy peered at me as we sat on the couch after the walk. Are you all right? What do you mean? I don't know. You seem a bit flat. Today? Not just today. Recently. I evaded her eyes. Just work. I've got a lot on my mind. Kathy nodded, a sympathetic squeeze of my hand. She was a good actress. I could almost believe she cared. How are rehearsals going? I asked. Better. Tony came up with some good ideas. We're going to work late next week to go over them. Right. I no longer believed a word she said. I analysed every sentence the way I would with a patient. I was looking for subtext, reading between the lines for non-verbal clues, subtle inflections, evasions, omissions, lies. How is Tony? I asked. Fine, she said with a shrug, as if to indicate she couldn't care less. I didn't believe that. She idolised Tony, her director, and was forever talking about him. At least she used to. She hadn't mentioned him quite so much recently. They talked about plays and acting and the theatre, a world beyond my knowledge. I'd heard a lot about Tony, but only glimpsed him once, briefly, when I went to meet Kathy after rehearsal. I thought it odd that Kathy didn't introduce us. He was married and his wife was an actress. I got the sense Kathy didn't like her much. Perhaps his wife was jealous of their relationship, as I was. I suggested the four of us go out for dinner, but Kathy hadn't been particularly keen on the idea. Sometimes I wondered if she were trying to keep us apart. I watched Kathy open her laptop. She angled the screen away from me as she typed. I could hear her fingers tapping. Who was she writing to?
Tony.
What are you doing? I asked, yawning.
Just emailing my cousin. She's in Sydney now.
Is she? Send her my love.
I will.
Kathy typed for a moment longer, then stopped typing and put down the laptop.
I'm going to have a bath.
I nodded.
Okay.
She gave me an amused look.
Cheer up, darling. Are you sure you're okay?
I smiled and nodded. She stood up and walked out. I waited until I heard the bathroom door close and the sound of running water. I slid over to where she'd been sitting. I reached for her laptop. My fingers were trembling as I opened it. I reopened her browser and went to her email login, but she'd logged out. I pushed away the laptop with disgust. At some point this must stop, I thought. This way madness lies. Or was I mad already? I was getting into bed, pulling back the covers, when Kathy walked into the bedroom, brushing her teeth.
I forgot to tell you, Nicole is back in London next week.
Nicole? You remember Nicole. We went to her going away party.
Oh, yeah, I thought she moved to New York.
She did, and now she's back. A pause. She wants me to meet her on Thursday at night after rehearsal. I don't know what aroused my suspicion. Was it the way Kathy was looking in my direction but not making eye contact? I sensed she was lying. I didn't say anything. Neither did she. She disappeared from the door, and I could hear her in the bathroom, spitting out the toothpaste and rinsing her mouth. Perhaps there was nothing to it. Perhaps it was entirely innocent and Kathy really was going to meet Nicole on Thursday. Perhaps. Only one way to find out. Chapter 19. There were no queues outside Alicia's gallery this time, as there had been that day 6 years ago when I had gone to see the Alcestis. A different artist was hanging in the window now, and despite his possible talent, he lacked Alicia's notoriety and subsequent ability to draw in the crowds. As I entered the gallery, I shivered. It was even colder in here than on the street. There was something chilly about the atmosphere as well as the temperature. It smelled of exposed steel beams and bare concrete floors. It was soulless, I thought. Empty. The gallerist was sitting behind his desk. He stood up as I approached. John Felix Martin was in his early 40s, a handsome man with black eyes and hair, and a tight t-shirt with a red skull on it. I told him who I was and why I had come. To my surprise, he seemed perfectly happy to talk about Alicia. He spoke with an accent. I asked if he was French.
Originally from Paris, but I've been here since I was a student, 20 years at least. I think of myself more as British these days.
He smiled and gestured to a back room.
Come in, we can have coffee.
Thanks. John Felix led me into an office which was essentially a storeroom, crowded with stacks of paintings.
How is she, Alicia?
He asked, using a complicated-looking coffee machine.
Is she still not talking?
I shook my head.
No.
He nodded and sighed.
So sad. Won't you sit down? What do you want to know? I'll do my best to answer truthfully.
Jean-Félix gave me a wry smile, tinged with curiosity,
although I'm not entirely sure why you've come to me.
You and Alicia were close, weren't you? Apart from your professional relationship.
Who told you that?
Gabriel's brother, Max Berenson, he suggested I talk to you.
John Felix rolled his eyes.
Oh, so you saw Max, did you? What a bore. He said it with such contempt I couldn't help laughing.
You know Max Berenson.
Well enough, better than I'd like. He handed me a small cup of coffee. Alicia and I were close, very close. We knew each other for years, long before she met Gabriel.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, yes, we were at art school together, and after we graduated, we painted together.
You mean you collaborated?
Well, not really, John Felix laughed. I mean we painted walls together, as house painters. I smiled.
Oh, I see.
It turned out I was better at painting walls than paintings, so I gave up, about the same time as Alicia's art started to really take off. And when I started running this place, it made sense for me to show Alicia's work. It was a very natural, organic process. Yes, it sounds like it. And what about Gabriel? What about him? I sensed a prickliness here, a defensive reaction that told me this was an avenue worth exploring. Well, I wonder how he fit into this dynamic. Presumably you knew him quite well. Not really. No? Nope. John Felix hesitated a second. Gabriel didn't take time to know me. He was very caught up in himself. Sounds like you didn't like him. I didn't particularly. I don't think he liked me. In fact, I know he didn't. Why was that? I have no idea. Do you think perhaps he was jealous of your relationship with Alicia? John Felix sipped his coffee and nodded. Yeah, yes, possibly. He saw you as a threat, perhaps. You tell me. Sounds like you have all the answers. I took the hint. I didn't push it any further. Instead, I tried a different approach. You saw Alicia a few days before the murder, I believe. Yes, I went to the house to see her. Can you tell me a little about that? Well, she had an exhibition coming up and she was behind with her work. She was rightfully concerned. You hadn't seen any of the new work? No, she'd been putting me off for ages. I thought I'd better check on her. I expected she'd be in the studio at the end of the garden, but she wasn't. No? No, I found her in the house. How did you get in? John Felix looked surprised by the question. What? I could tell he was making some quick mental evaluation. Then he nodded. Oh, I see what you mean, he said. Well, there was a gate that led from the street to the back garden. It was usually unlocked. And from the garden I went into the kitchen through the back door, which was also unlocked. He smiled. You know, you sound more like a detective than a psychiatrist. I'm a psychotherapist. Is there a difference? I'm just trying to understand Alicia's mental state. How did you experience her mood? John Felix shrugged. She seemed fine, a little stressed about work. Is that all? She didn't look like she was going to shoot her husband in a few days, if that's what you mean. She seemed fine. He drained his coffee and hesitated as a thought struck him. Would you like to see some of her paintings? Without waiting for a reply, John Felix got up and walked to the door, beckoning me to follow. Come on. Chapter 20. I followed John Felix into a storage room. He went over to a large case, pulled out a hinged rack, and lifted out three paintings wrapped in blankets. He propped them up. He carefully unwrapped each one. Then he stood back and presented the first one to me with a flourish. Voila! I looked at it. The painting had the same photorealistic quality as the rest of Alicia's work. It was an almost photographic representation of the car accident that killed her mother. A woman's body was sitting in the wreck, slumped at the wheel. She was bloodied and obviously dead. Her spirit, her soul, was rising from the corpse, like a large bird with yellow wings soaring to the heavens. Isn't it glorious? Said John Felix, gazing at it. All those yellows and reds and greens, I could get lost in it. It's joyous. Joyous wasn't the word I would have chosen. Unsettling, perhaps. I wasn't sure how I felt about it. I moved on to the next picture, a painting of Jesus on the cross. Or was it? It's Gabriel, John Felix said. It's a good likeness. It was Gabriel, but Gabriel portrayed as Jesus, crucified, hanging from the cross, blood trickling from his wounds, a crown of thorns on his head. His eyes were not downcast, but staring out, unblinking, tortured, unashamedly reproachful. They seemed to burn right through me. I peered at the picture more closely, at the incongruous item strapped to Gabriel's torso, a rifle. That's the gun that killed him? Jean Felix nodded. Yes, it belonged to him, I think. And this was painted before his murder, a month or so before. It shows you what was on Alicia's mind, doesn't it? John Felix moved on to the third picture. It was a larger canvas than the others. This one's the best. Stand back to get a better look. I did as he said and took a few paces back. Then I turned and looked. The moment I saw the painting, I let out an involuntary laugh. The subject was Alicia's aunt, Lydia Rose, and it was obvious why she had been upset by it. Lydia was nude, reclining on a tiny bed. The bed was buckling under her weight. She was enormously, monstrously fat, an explosion of flesh spilling over the bed and hitting the floor and spreading across the room, rippling and folding like waves of grey custard. "Jesus," I said, "that's cruel." "I think it's quite lovely." John Felix looked at me with interest. "You know Lydia?" "Yes, I went to visit her." "I see," he said with a smile. "You have been doing your homework. I never met Lydia. Alicia hated her, you know." "Yes," I said, staring at the painting. "Yes, I can see that." John Felix began carefully wrapping up the pictures again. "And the Alcestis?" I said. "Can I see it?"
"Of course. Follow me."
John Felix led me along the narrow passage to the end of the gallery. There the Alcestis occupied a wall to itself. It was just as beautiful and mysterious as I remembered it. Alicia, naked in the studio in front of a blank canvas, painting with a blood-red paintbrush. I studied Alicia's expression. Again, it defied interpretation. I frowned. "She's impossible to read. That's the point. It's a refusal to comment. It's a painting about silence."
"I'm not sure I understand what you mean."
"Well, at the heart of all art lies a mystery. Alicia's silence is her secret, her mystery in the religious sense. That's why she named it Alcestis. Have you read it, by Euripides?" He gave me a curious look. "Read it, then you'll understand."
I nodded, and then I noticed something in the painting I hadn't seen before. I leaned forward to look closely. A bowl of fruit sat on the table in the background of the picture, a collection of apples and pears, and on the red apples there were some small white blobs, white slippery blobs creeping in and around the fruit. I pointed at them.
"Are they maggots?" John Felix nodded. "Yes."
"Fascinating. I wonder what that means."
"It's wonderful, a masterpiece, it really is."
John Felix sighed and glanced at me across the portrait. He lowered his voice, as if Alicia were able to hear us.
"It's a shame you didn't know her then. She was the most interesting person I've ever met. Most people aren't alive, you know, not really, sleepwalking their way through life, but Alicia was so intensely alive. It was hard to take your eyes off her."
John Felix turned his head back to the painting and gazed at Alicia's naked body.
"So beautiful."
I looked back at Alicia's body, but where John Felix saw beauty, I saw only pain. I saw self-inflicted wounds and scars of self-harm. "Did she ever talk to you about her suicide attempt?" I was fishing, but John Felix took the bait.
"Oh, you know about that. Yes, of course. After her father died, she went to pieces," he nodded.
"The truth is, Alicia was hugely fucked up, not as an artist, but as a person. She was extremely vulnerable. When her father hanged himself, it was too much. She couldn't cope."
"She must have loved him a great deal."
John Felix gave a kind of strangled laugh. He looked at me like I was mad.
"What are you talking about?"
"What do you mean?"
"Alicia didn't love him. She hated her father. She despised him."
I was taken aback by this. "Alicia told you that?"
"Of course she did. She hated him ever since she was a kid, ever since her mother died."
"But then why try to commit suicide after his death? If it wasn't grief, what was it?"
John Felix shrugged. "Guilt, perhaps, who knows?"
There was something he wasn't telling me, I thought. Something that didn't fit. Something was wrong. His phone rang.
"Excuse me a moment," he said.
He turned away from me to answer it. There was a woman's voice on the other end. They talked for a moment, arranging a time to meet.
"I'll call you back, baby," he said, and hung up.
John Felix turned back to me.
"Sorry about that."
"That's all right. Your girlfriend?" He smiled.
Just a friend. I have a lot of friends. I'll bet you do, I thought. I felt a flicker of dislike. I wasn't sure why. As he showed me out, I asked a final question. Just one more thing. Did Alicia ever mention a doctor to you?
A doctor?
Apparently she saw a doctor around the time of her suicide attempt. I'm trying to locate him. John Felix frowned. Possibly. There was someone. Can you remember his name? He thought for a second and shook his head.
I'm sorry, no, I honestly can't.
Well, if it comes to you, perhaps you can let me know.
Sure, but I doubt it.
He glanced at me and hesitated. You want some advice?
I'd welcome some.
If you really want to get Alicia to talk, give her some paint and brushes. Let her paint. That's the only way she'll talk to you. Through her art.
That's an interesting idea. You've been very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Martin.
Call me Jean-Félix. And when you see Alicia, tell her I love her. He smiled, and again I felt a slight repulsion. There was something about Jean-Félix I found hard to stomach. I could tell he had been genuinely close to Alicia. They had known each other a long time, and he was obviously attracted to her. Was he in love with her? I wasn't so sure. I thought of Jean-Félix's face when he was looking at the Alcestis. Yes, there was love in his eyes, but love for the painting, not necessarily the painter. It was the art Jean-Félix coveted. Otherwise, he would have visited Alicia at the Grove. He would have stuck by her. I knew that for a fact. A man never abandons a woman like that. Not if he loves her.
Chapter 21. I went into Waterstones on my way to work and bought a copy of Alcestis. The introduction said it was Euripides' earliest extant tragedy and one of his least performed works. I started reading it on the tube. Not exactly a page-turner. An odd play, really. The hero, Admetus, is condemned to death by the fates. But thanks to Apollo's negotiating, he is offered a loophole. Admetus can escape death if he is able to persuade someone else to die for him. He proceeds to ask his mother and father to die in his place, and they refuse in no uncertain terms. It's hard to know what to make of Admetus at this point. Not exactly heroic behaviour by any standards, and the ancient Greeks must have thought him a bit of a twit. Alcestis is made of stronger stuff. She steps forward and volunteers to die for her husband. Perhaps she doesn't expect Admetus to accept her offer, but he does, and Alcestis proceeds to die and depart for Hades. It doesn't end there, though. There is a happy ending of sorts, a deus ex machina. Heracles seizes Alcestis from Hades and brings her triumphantly back to the land of the living. She comes alive again. Admetus is moved to tears by the reunion with his wife. Alcestis' emotions are harder to read. She remains silent. She doesn't speak. I sat up with a jolt as I read this. I couldn't believe it. I read the final page of the play again, slowly, carefully. Alcestis returns from death, alive again, and she remains silent, unable or unwilling to speak of her experience. Admetus appeals to Heracles in desperation, but why is my wife standing here and does not speak? There is no answer forthcoming. The tragedy ends with Alcestis being led back into the house by Admetus in silence. Why? Why does she not speak?
Chapter 22. Alicia Berenson's Diary. 2nd of August. It's even hotter today. It's hotter in London than in Athens, apparently, but at least Athens has a beach. Paul called me today from Cambridge. I was surprised to hear his voice. We've not spoken in months. My first thought was Auntie Lydia must be dead. I'm not ashamed to say I felt a flicker of relief, but that's not why Paul was calling. In fact, I'm still not sure why he did call me. He was pretty evasive. I kept waiting for him to get to the point, but he didn't. He kept asking if I was okay, if Gabriel was okay, and muttered something about Lydia being the same as always. I'll come for a visit, I said. I haven't been for ages. I've been meaning to. The truth is, I have many complicated feelings around going home and being at the house with Lydia and Paul. So I avoid going back, and I end up feeling guilty, so I can't win either way. It'd be nice to catch up, I said. I'll come and see you soon. I'm just about to go out, so... And then Paul spoke so quietly I couldn't hear him. Sorry, I said. Can you repeat that?
I said, I'm in trouble, Alicia. I need your help.
What's the matter? I can't talk about it on the phone. I need to see you. It's just I'm not sure I can make it up to Cambridge at the minute. I'll come to you this afternoon. Okay? There was something in Paul's voice that made me agree without thinking about it. He sounded desperate. Okay, I said. Are you sure you can't tell me about it now? I'll see you later, Paul said, and he hung up. I kept thinking about it for the rest of the morning. What could be serious enough that Paul would turn to me, of all people? Was it about Lydia? Or the house, perhaps? It didn't make sense. I wasn't able to get any work done after lunch. I blamed the heat, but in truth, my mind was elsewhere. I hung around in the kitchen, glancing out of the windows, until I saw Paul on the street. He waved at me.
Alicia, hi.
The first thing that struck me was how terrible he looked. He'd lost a lot of weight, particularly around his face, the temples and jaw. He looked skeletal, unwell, exhausted, scared. We sat in the kitchen with a portable fan on. I offered him a beer, but he said he'd rather have something stronger, which surprised me, because I don't remember him being much of a drinker. I poured him a whiskey, a small one, and he topped it up when he thought I wasn't looking. He didn't say anything at first. We sat there in silence for a moment, and then he repeated what he had said on the phone. The same words. I'm in trouble. I asked him what he meant. Was it about the house? Paul looked at me blankly. No, it wasn't the house. Then what? It's me, he said. He hesitated for a moment and then he came out with it. I've been gambling and losing a lot, I'm afraid. It turns out he's been gambling regularly for years. He said it started as a way of getting out of the house, somewhere to go, something to do, a bit of fun, and I can't say I blame him. Living with Lydia, fun must be in short supply. But he's been losing more and more, and now it's got out of hand. He's been dipping into the savings account, and there wasn't much there to start with. How much do you need? I asked. 20 grand. I couldn't believe my ears. You lost 20 grand?
Not all at once. And I borrowed from some people, and now they want it back.
What people? If I don't pay them back, I'm going to be in trouble. Have you told your mother? I already knew the answer to that question. Paul may be a mess, but he's not stupid.
Of course not. Mum would kill me. I need your help, Alicia. That's why I'm here.
I haven't got that kind of money, Paul. I'll pay it back. I don't need it all at once, just something. I didn't say anything, and he kept pleading. They wanted something tonight. He didn't dare go back empty-handed. Whatever I could give him, anything. I didn't know what to do. I wanted to help him, but I suspected giving him money wasn't the way to deal with this. I also knew his debts were going to be a tough secret to keep from Auntie Lydia. I don't know what I'd do if I were Paul. Facing up to Lydia was probably scarier than the loan sharks. I'll write you a check, I said finally. Paul seemed pathetically grateful and kept muttering, thank you, thank you. I wrote him a cheque for £2,000 payable to cash. I know that's not what he wanted, but the whole thing was uncharted territory for me, and I'm not sure I believed everything he said. Something about it didn't ring true. Maybe I can give you more once I've talked to Gabriel, I said, but it's better if you work out another way to handle this. You know, Gabriel's brother is a solicitor. Maybe he could... Paul jumped up, terrified, shaking his head. No, he kept saying. No, no, don't tell Gabriel. Don't involve him. Please, I'll work out how to handle it. I'll work it out. What about Lydia? I think maybe you should... Paul shook his head fiercely and took the cheque. He looked disappointed at the amount but didn't say anything. He left soon afterwards. I have the feeling I let him down. is a feeling I've always had about Paul since we were kids. I've always failed to live up to his expectations of me, that I should be a mothering figure to him. He should know me better than that. I am not the mothering type. I told Gabriel about it when he got back, and of course he was annoyed with me. He said I shouldn't have given Paul any money, that I don't owe him anything. He's not my responsibility. I know Gabriel is right, but the truth is I can't help feeling guilty. I escaped from that house, and from Lydia. Paul didn't. He's still trapped there. He's still 8 years old. I want to help him, but I don't know how. 6th of August. I spent all day painting, experimenting with the background of the Jesus picture. I've been making sketches from the photos we took in Mexico. Red, cracked earth, dark, spiny shrubs, thinking about how to capture that heat, that intense dryness. And then I heard Jean-Félix calling my name. I thought about ignoring him for a second, pretending I wasn't there, but then I heard the clink of the gate, and it was too late. I stuck my head outside and he was walking across the garden. He waved at me. "Hey, babes," he said. "Am I disturbing you? Are you working?" "I am, actually." "Good, good," he said. "Keep at it. Only 6 weeks till the exhibition, you know. You're horribly behind." He laughed that annoying laugh of his. My expression must have given me away because he added quickly, "Only joking. I'm not here to check up on you." I didn't say anything. I just went back into the studio and he followed. He pulled up a chair in front of the fan. He lit a cigarette and the smoke whirled about him in the breeze. I went back to the easel and picked up my brush. Jean-Félix talked as I worked. He complained about the heat, saying London wasn't designed to cope with this kind of weather. He compared it unfavorably with Paris and other cities. I stopped listening after a while. He went on, complaining, self-justifying, self-pitying, boring me to death. He never asks me anything. He doesn't have any actual interest in me. Even after all these years, I'm just a means to an end, an audience of the Jean-Félix show. Maybe that's unkind. He's an old friend and he's always been there for me. He's lonely, that's all. So am I. Well, I'd rather be lonely than be with the wrong person. That's why I never had any serious relationships before Gabriel. I was waiting for Gabriel, for someone real, as solid and true as the others were false. Jean-Félix was always jealous of our relationship. He tried to hide it, and still does, but it's obvious to me he hates Gabriel. He's always bitching about him, implying Gabriel's not as talented as I am, that he's vain and egocentric. I think Jean-Félix believes that one day he will win me over to his side and I'll fall at his feet. But what he doesn't realise is that with every snide comment and bitchy remark, he drives me further into Gabriel's arms. Jean-Félix is always alluding to our long, long friendship. It's the hold he has on me. The intensity of those early years when it was just us against the world. But I don't think Jean-Félix realises he's holding on to a part of my life when I wasn't happy. And any affection I have for Jean-Félix is for that time. We're like a married couple who has fallen out of love. Today, I realised quite how much I dislike him. "I'm working," I said. "I need to get on with this, so if you don't mind." Jean-Félix pulled a face. "Are you asking me to leave? I've been watching you paint since you first picked up a brush. If I've been a distraction all these years, you might have said something sooner."
"I'm saying something now."
My face was feeling hot and I was getting angry. I couldn't control it. I tried to paint, but my hand was shaking. I could feel Jean-Félix watching me. I could practically hear his mind working, ticking, whirring, spinning. "I've upset you," he said at last.
"Why?"
"I just told you. You can't keep popping over like this. You need to text me or call first."
"I didn't realise I needed a written invitation to see my best friend."
There was a pause. He'd taken it badly. I guess there was no other way to take it. I hadn't planned on telling him like this. I'd intended to break it to him more gently, but somehow I was unable to stop myself. And the funny thing is, I wanted to hurt him. I wanted to be brutal. "Jean-Félix, listen."
"I'm listening,"
There's no easy way to say this, but after the show, it's time for a change. Change of what? Change of gallery, for me. Jean-Félix looked at me, astonished. He looked like a little boy, I thought, about to burst into tears, and I found myself feeling nothing but irritation. It's time for a fresh start, I said. For both of us. I see. He lit another cigarette. And I suppose this is Gabriel's idea. Gabriel's got nothing to do with it. He hates my guts. Don't be stupid. He poisoned you against me. I've seen it happening. He's been doing it for years. That's not true. What other explanation is there? What other reason could you have for stabbing me in the back? Don't be so dramatic. This is only about the gallery. It's not about you and me. We'll still be friends. We can still hang out. If I text or call first. He laughed and started talking fast as if he was trying to get it out before I could stop him. Wow, he said. Wow, wow. All this time I really believed in something, you know, in you and me. And now you've decided it was nothing. Just like that. No one cares about you like I do, you know. No one. Jean-Félix, please. I can't believe you just decided like that. I've been wanting to tell you for a while. This was clearly the wrong thing to say. Jean-Félix looked stunned. What do you mean, a while? How long? I don't know, a while. And you've been acting for me, is that it? Christ, Alicia! Don't end it like this. Don't discard me like this. I'm not discarding you. Don't be so dramatic. We'll always be friends. Let's just slow down here. You know why I came over? To ask you to the theatre on Friday. He pulled two tickets from inside his jacket and showed them to me. They were for a tragedy by Euripides at the National. I'd like you to come with me. It's a more civilised way to say goodbye, don't you think? For old time's sake, don't say no. I hesitated. It was the last thing I wanted to do, but I didn't want to upset him further. At that point, I think I would have agreed to anything, just to get him out of there. So I said yes. 10:30 p.m. When Gabriel got home, I talked to him about what happened with Jean-Félix. He said he never understood our friendship anyway. He said Jean-Félix is creepy and he doesn't like the way he looks at me. And how is that? Like he owns you or something. I think you should leave the gallery now, before the show. I can't do that. It's too late. I don't want him to hate me. You don't know how vindictive he can be. It sounds like you're afraid of him. I'm not. It's just easier this way. To pull away gradually. The sooner the better. He's in love with you. You know that, don't you? I didn't argue. But Gabriel is wrong. Jean-Félix isn't in love with me. He's more attached to my paintings than he is to me. Which is another reason to get away from him. Jean-Félix doesn't care about me at all. Gabriel was right about one thing, though. I am afraid of him.
Chapter 23. I found Diomedes in his office. He was sitting on a stool in front of his golden stringed harp. That's a beautiful object, I said. Diomedes nodded. And very difficult to play. He demonstrated, sweeping his fingers lovingly along the strings. A cascading scale resounded through the room. Would you like to try? I smiled and shook my head. He laughed. I keep asking, you see, in the hope you will change your mind. I'm nothing if not persistent. I'm not very musical. I was told so in no uncertain terms by my music teacher at school. Like therapy, music is about a relationship entirely dependent on the teacher you choose. No doubt that's true. He glanced out of the window and nodded at the darkening sky. Those clouds, they have snow in them. It looks like rain clouds to me. No, it's snow, he said. Trust me, I come from a long line of Greek shepherds. It will be snowing tonight. Diomedes gave the clouds a last, hopeful look, then turned back to me. What can I do for you, Theo? It's this. I slid the copy of the play across the desk. He peered at it. What is it? A tragedy by Euripides. I can see that. Why are you showing it to me? Well, it's Alcestis, the title Alicia gave her self-portrait, painted after Gabriel's murder. Ah, yes, yes, of course. He looked at it with more interest.
casting herself as a tragic heroine. Possibly. I must admit I'm rather stumped. I thought you might have a better handle on it than me.
Because I'm Greek?
He laughed. You assume I will have an intimate knowledge of every Greek tragedy? Well, better than me, at any rate.
I don't see why. It's like assuming every Englishman is familiar with the works of Shakespeare.
He gave me a pitying smile. Fortunately for you, that is the difference between our countries. Every Greek knows his tragedies. The tragedies are our myths, our history, our blood.
Then you'll be able to help me with this one?
Diomedes picked it up and flicked through it.
And what is your difficulty?
My difficulty is the fact she doesn't speak. Alcestis dies for her husband, and at the end she comes back to life but remains silent.
Ah, like Alicia.
Yes.
Again, I pose the question, what is your difficulty?
Well, obviously there's a link, but I don't understand it. Why doesn't Alcestis speak at the end?
Well, why do you think?
I don't know. She's overcome with emotion, possibly?
Possibly. What kind of emotion?
Joy?
Joy?
He laughed.
Theo, think, how would you feel? The person you love most in the world has condemned you to die through their own cowardice. That's quite a betrayal.
You're saying she was upset.
Have you never been betrayed?
The question cut through me like a knife. I felt my face go red. My lips moved, but no sound came out. Diomedes smiled.
I can see that you have. So, tell me, how does Alcestis feel?
I knew the answer this time. Angry. She's angry.
Yes,
Diomedes nodded.
More than angry, she's murderous with rage.
He chuckled.
One can't help but wonder what their relationship will be like in the future, Alcestis and Admetus. Trust once lost is hard to recover.
It took a few seconds before I trusted myself to speak. And Alicia?
What about her?
Alcestis was condemned to die by her husband's cowardice, and Alicia... No, Alicia didn't die, not physically. He left the word hanging.
Psychically, on the other hand...
You mean something happened? To kill her spirit, to kill her sense of being alive?
Possibly.
I felt dissatisfied. I picked up the play and looked at it. On the cover was a classical statue, a beautiful woman immortalized in marble. I stared at it, thinking of what John Felix had said to me. If Alicia is dead, like Alcestis, then we need to bring her back to life.
Correct.
It occurs to me that if Alicia's art is her means of expression, how about we provide her with a voice?
And how do we do that?
How about we let her paint? Diomedes gave me a surprised look, followed by a dismissive wave of his hand.
She already has art therapy. I'm not talking about art therapy, I'm talking about Alicia working on her own terms, alone, with her own space to create. Let her express herself, free up her emotions. It might work wonders.
Diomedes didn't reply for a moment. He mulled it over.
You'll have to square it with her art therapist.
Have you come across her yet? Rowena Hart? She's no pushover.
I'll talk to her. But I have your blessing.
Diomedes shrugged. If you can persuade Rowena, go ahead. I can tell you now she won't like the idea. She won't like it one bit.
Chapter 24. I think it's a great idea, said Rowena.
You do? I tried not to look surprised.
Really?
Oh yes, only problem is Alicia won't go for it.
What makes you so sure?
Rowena gave a derisive snort.
Because Alicia's the least responsive, most uncommunicative bitch I've ever worked with.
Ah.
I followed Rowena into the art room. The floor was splashed with paint like an abstract mosaic, and the walls covered with artwork. Some of it good, most just weird. Rowena had short blonde hair, a deep-etched frown, and a weary, put-upon manner, doubtless due to her endless sea of uncooperative patience. Alicia was clearly one such disappointment. She doesn't participate in art therapy, I said. She does not. Rowena continued stacking artwork on a shelf as she spoke. I had high hopes when she joined the group. I did everything I could to make her feel welcome, but she just sits there staring at the blank page. Nothing will induce her to paint or even pick up a pencil and draw. Terrible example to the others. I nodded sympathetically. The purpose of art therapy is to get the patients drawing and painting and, more importantly, talking about their artwork, linking it to their emotional state. It's a great way to literally get their unconscious onto the page, where it can be thought about and talked about. As always, it comes down to the individual skill of the therapist. Ruth used to say that too few therapists were skilled or intuitive. Most were just plumbers. Rowena was, in my opinion, very much a plumber. It was obvious she felt snubbed by Alicia. I tried to be as placating as possible. Perhaps it's painful for her, I suggested gently.
Painful?
Well, it can't be easy for an artist of her ability to sit and paint with the other patients.
Why not? Because she's above it. I've seen her work. I don't rate her highly at all.
She sucked in her mouth like she had tasted something unpleasant. So that was why Rowena disliked Alicia. She was jealous.
Anyone can paint like that, she said. It's not difficult to represent something photorealistically. What's harder is to have a point of view about it.
I didn't want to get into a debate about Alicia's art. So what you're saying is you'll be relieved if I take her off your hands?
Rowena shot me a sharp look. You're welcome to her.
Thank you. I'm grateful.
Rowena sniffed contemptuously. You'll need to supply the art materials. My budget doesn't stretch to oils.
Chapter 25. I have a confession to make. Alicia didn't look at me. I went on, watching her carefully. I happened to pass your old gallery the other day when I was in Soho, so I went inside. The manager was kind enough to show me some of your work. He's an old friend of yours, John Felix Martin? I waited for a response. None came. I hope you don't think it was an invasion of your privacy. Perhaps I should have consulted you first. I hope you don't mind. No response. I saw a couple of paintings I'd not seen before, the one of your mother and the one of your aunt, Lydia Rose. Alicia slowly raised her head and looked at me. There was an expression in her eyes I'd not seen before. I couldn't quite place it. Was it amusement? Quite apart from the obvious interest for me, as your therapist, I mean, I found the paintings affecting on a personal level. They're extremely powerful pieces. Alicia's eyes lowered. She was losing interest. I persevered quickly. A couple of things struck me. In the painting of your mother's car accident, there's something missing from the picture. You didn't paint yourself in the car, even though you were there. No reaction. I wondered if that means you're only able to think of it as her tragedy because she died. But in fact, there was also a little girl in that car, a girl whose feelings of loss were, I suspect, neither validated nor fully experienced. Alicia's head moved. She glanced at me. It was a challenging look. I was onto something. I kept going. I asked John Felix about your self-portrait, Alcestis, about its meaning, and he suggested I have a look at this. I pulled out the copy of the play, Alcestis. I slid it across the coffee table. Alicia glanced at it. Why does she not speak? That's what Admetus asks. And I'm asking you the same question, Alicia. What is it that you can't say? Why do you have to keep silent? Alicia closed her eyes, making me disappear. Conversation over. I glanced at the clock on the wall behind her. The session was nearly finished. A couple of minutes remained. I had been saving my trump card until now, and I played it with a feeling of nervousness which I hoped wasn't apparent. John Felix made a suggestion. I thought it was rather a good one. He thought you should be allowed to paint. Would you like that? We could provide you with a private space with canvases and brushes and paints. Alicia blinked. Her eyes opened. It was like a light had been switched on inside them. They were the eyes of a child, wide and innocent, free of scorn or suspicion. Colour seemed to come into her face. Suddenly she seemed wonderfully alive. I had a word with Professor Diomedes. He's agreed to it. And so has Rowena. So it's up to you, really, Alicia. What do you think? I waited. She stared at me. And then, finally, I got what I wanted. A definite reaction. A sign that told me I was on the right track. It was a small movement, tiny, really. Nonetheless, it spoke volumes. Alicia smiled. Chapter 26. The canteen was the warmest room at the Grove. Piping hot radiators lined the walls, and the benches closest to them were always filled first. Lunch was the busiest meal, with staff and patients eating side by side. The raised voices of the diners created a cacophony of noise, born from an uncomfortable excitement when all the patients were in the same space. A couple of jolly Caribbean dinner ladies laughed and chatted as they served up bangers and mash, fish and chips, chicken curry, all of which smelled better than they tasted. I selected fish and chips as the lesser of three evils. On my way to sit down, I passed Alif. She was surrounded by her gang, a surly-looking crew of the toughest patients. She was complaining about the food as I walked by her table.
"I'm not eating this shit,"
she said, pushing away her tray. The patient to her right pulled the tray towards her, preparing to take it off her hands, but Alif whacked her across the head.
"Greedy bitch!" Alif shouted. "Give that back!"
This prompted a guffaw of laughter round the table. Alif pulled back her plate and tucked into her meal with renewed relish. Alicia was sitting alone, I noticed, at the back of the room. She was picking at a meagre bit of fish like an anorexic bird, moving it around the plate but not bringing it to her mouth. I was half tempted to sit with her but decided against it. Perhaps if she had looked up and made eye contact I would have walked over, but she kept her gaze lowered, as if attempting to block out her surroundings and those around her. It felt like an invasion of privacy to intrude, so I sat at the end of another table, a few spaces away from any patients, and started eating my fish and chips. I ate just a mouthful of the soggy fish, which was tasteless, reheated but still cold in the centre. I concurred with Alif's appraisal. I was about to throw it in the bin when someone sat down opposite me. To my surprise, it was Christian. "All right," he said with a nod. "Yeah, you?" Christian didn't reply. He hacked with determination through the rock-solid rice and curry. "I heard about your plan to get Alicia painting," he said between mouthfuls. "I see news travels fast." "It does in this place. Your idea?" I hesitated. "It was, yes. I think it'll be good for her." Christian gave me a doubtful look.
"Be careful, mate."
"Thanks for the warning, but it's rather unnecessary."
"I'm just saying, borderlines are seductive. That's what's going on here. I don't think you fully get that."
"She's not going to seduce me, Christian."
He laughed. "I think she already has. You're giving her just what she wants."
"I'm giving her what she needs. There's a difference." "How do you know what she needs? You're over-identifying with her. It's obvious. She's the patient, you know, not you." I looked at my watch in an attempt to disguise my anger. "I have to go." I stood up and picked up my tray. I started walking away, but Christian called after me.
"She'll turn on you, Theo," he said. "Just wait. Don't say I didn't warn you."
I felt annoyed, and the annoyance stayed with me for the rest of the day. After work, I left the Grove and went to the small shop at the end of the road to buy a pack of cigarettes. I put a cigarette in my mouth, lit it, and inhaled deeply, barely conscious of my actions. I was thinking about what Christian had said, going over it in my mind while the cars sped past. "Borderlines are seductive," I heard him saying. Was it true? Was that why I was so annoyed? Had Alicia emotionally seduced me? Christian clearly thought so, and I had no doubt Diomedes suspected it. Were they right? Searching my conscience, I felt confident the answer was no. I wanted to help Alicia, yes, but I was also perfectly able to remain objective about her, stay vigilant, tread carefully, and keep firm boundaries. I was wrong, of course. It was already too late. Though I wouldn't admit this, even to myself. I called John Felix at the gallery. I asked what had happened to Alicia's art materials, her paints, brushes, and canvases. "Is it all in storage?" There was a slight pause before he answered.
"Well, no, actually. I have all her stuff."
"You do?"
"Yes, I cleared out her studio after the trial and got hold of everything worth keeping. All her preliminary sketches, notebooks, her easel, her oils. I'm storing it all for her." How nice of you.
So you're following my advice, letting Alicia paint?
Yes, I said. Whether anything will come of it remains to be seen.
Or something will come of it. You'll see. All I ask is you let me have a look at the finished paintings.
There was a strange note of hunger in his voice. I had a sudden image of Alicia's pictures swaddled like babies in blankets in that storage room. Was he really keeping them safe for her, or because he couldn't bear to let go of them?
Would you mind dropping off the materials to the Grove? I said. Would that be convenient?
There was a moment's hesitation. I felt his anxiety. I found myself coming to his rescue.
Or I can pick them up from you if that's easier.
Yes, perhaps that would be better, he said.
John Felix was scared of coming here. Scared of seeing Alicia. Why? What was there between them? What was it that he didn't want to face?